to the second case this morning, Harvey v. Town of Merrillville.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Elizabeth Tate. There are two major issues and one minor issue before the court today. The first is the application of Costello. The second is whether appellant's free speech rights were violated. And the third is whether appellants appeal the right order as to Warmalink. I will focus my argument on the first two major issues. The court only needs to look at the briefs to determine whether or not appellees made arguments concerning similarly situated class and policy. The town in its brief on page 58 sets out the elements of a 1983 claim. Inconspicuously absent is an application of the facts that were adduced during discovery concerning similarly situated class. The town's brief focused on legitimate, non-discriminatory reasons for failing to take the Innsbruck Pond into its inventory. This argument assumes that the communities were similarly situated, and it also assumes that there was disparate treatment. The district court ruled that there was no evidence of similarly situated class or policy. These arguments were raised sua sponte by the court.
Well, now, wait a minute. Page 59 of your opponent's, the town's summary judgment brief says, quite simply, the plaintiffs cannot establish that there exist similarly situated communities to serve as comparators. That's point blank the argument. It's right there.
They don't apply any facts to that.
You know, you're so focused on the racial aspect of it, but there's the posture of this case as well. In other words, the zoning status of your client's situation is quite different than all these other communities you assert are comparators.
Your Honor, if I may take you to the record, both of the communities in Document 541, Attachment 8, Document 528, Attachment 6, were zoned R2. Even if the court did not exceed its authority, there are seven ways that Innsbruck was similar to Madison Meadows. And with your permission, I'd like to show how the record establishes that fact. The first point is both residents appeared at Plan Commission meetings and voiced concerns. That's Document 541, Attachment 8, Document 528, Attachment 6. Both were development of single-family homes. Document 541, Attachment 8, Document 528, Attachment 6. Both were zoned R2. Document 541, Attachment 8, Document 528, Attachment 6. The town administered the same subdivision ordinances to both developments. Document 542, 545, Exhibit 2, Document 541, Exhibit 6, Document 528, Exhibits 2, 5, 6, 7, and 8, Document 527, Exhibit 3, Document 530, Exhibits 3, 4, and 5.
Were they all in the same zoning status? Were they all at the same stage in the proceeding that your subdevelopment was?
Yes, they were. What happened
that
was...
That doesn't seem to be supported by the record.
In 2001,
they seem to all be in different stages.
No, in May 15th of 2001, the Innsbruck residents came and they voiced concerns. They were concerned about mosquitoes and flooding, and they were told that Vern Washburn had his right to develop his property. When the Madison Meadows remonstrators came, they voiced their concerns, and they got results. It was over a period of four years.
About 6 years later, wasn't it?
What happened was there's two levels of similarity, Your Honor. One, when the preliminary subdivision approval was established in 2001 in Innsbruck, and they came and voiced concerns and they were turned away. And then also at the same time that Madison Meadows was being approved, they renewed their efforts to get their concerns addressed, and they were turned away. They were ignored, and they were turned away. So there's two levels. Back in 2001, they did it, and they received disparate treatment. Back in 2005, they did it again, and they received disparate treatment. The next thing that's similar about the case is that they both had final plats to be recorded. That was document 541, exhibits 5, 6, and 7. The next similarity is that both residents were concerned about running sump pumps in traffic. Document 540, exhibit 6, document 524, exhibit 3, document 547, exhibit 4. And the last point is Ralph Mays was called a nigger, and that was in document 509, exhibit 1.
That epithet was used by a guy named Taylor, is that right?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Isn't Taylor an African American?
He was, but it still showed...
It still is, I suppose.
It still showed racial animus. Doesn't matter that he was African American. It called out my clients because of their race.
Well, it doesn't necessarily show racial animus in the African American community. It's not when one member of that community calls another one that term. It doesn't necessarily mean animus.
Well, when you're dealing with a situation where there's a bunch of Caucasians and a black person uses that term, I think that it does have animus. There's cultural differences in that. I think that blacks among blacks can get away with that. But when a black person does that in a setting such as this one, it's racial animus. With regard to disparate treatment, there are 15 ways that Innsbruck was treated disparately. And if we had been given a chance by the district court to explain these similarities, we wouldn't be here today. There are 15 ways they were treated differently, and I'd like to take you to the record. Number one, the final plat recorded for Innsbruck was 3 years and 2 months late. That's in document 417, Exhibit 1. Two, the final plats for Medicine Meadows were recorded within 1 year, document 416, Exhibits 2 and 3. Three, developer Van Pruyen was required to address the sophomore traffic issues, document 426, Exhibit 3, document 522, Exhibit 1. Four, the town refused to listen to Innsbruck about traffic, Exhibit 1, document 422. Five, Van Pruyen was required to create a homeowners association to take care of the pond there, document 528, Exhibit 6. Six, Washburn wasn't required to form a homeowners association. That's in document 442. Seven, the town tried to make the residents form a homeowners association to pay for the defective pond. That's document 418, Exhibit 3, document 418, Exhibit 1. Eight, Van Pruyen was required to solve sophomores running sump pumps, Exhibit 3, document 426, document 538, Exhibit 3. Nothing was done about Innsbruck's running sump pumps. That's Exhibit 4 and document 520. Innsbruck complained of flooding and mosquitoes at preliminary approval, and Innsbruck was told Washburn had a right to develop his property. Exhibit 2, document 530. Van Pruyen was required to post a performance bond. Document 426, Exhibit 1. Washburn was not required to post a performance bond. Document 524, Exhibit 1. Van Pruyen was required to use silt fences, Exhibit 1 of Document 522, and there were no silt fences for Innsbruck. Document 524, Exhibit 3. Washburn was not required to have a notice of intent with IDEM. That's Document 525, Exhibit 1. The court also raised the issue that there was no evidence of policy. This ruling is puzzling. The town in its brief has a whole section of facts entitled The Town's Policy on Maintaining Privately Owned Retention Ponds. That's on page 35, and we incorporate those facts into our argument.
I'm curious about your speech theory. Do you contend that you have your clients have an equal protection claim based on racially disparate treatment and a separate free speech claim?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
And what's the nature of the claim? It sounds like they did a lot of speaking. I don't see any inhibition on their speaking.
Your Honor, there are four ways in the record that show that their free speech was violated. And if I may take you to those 4 points.
Well, tell me what the theory is. Is it that their numerous complaints weren't listened to?
No, the theory is that Christian was representing the town, and she was instructed by the town attorney not to speak. That's in Exhibits 5 and 6 in Document 520. And the other point is that Christian spoke at a Plan Commission meeting.
Tell me again about this, that she was, who was representing who?
Christian was representing the Innsbruck residents, and she was told not to speak.
She was representing Benford King in a suit that King had filed, correct?
On behalf, she chose Benford King as one resident to file the lawsuit,
right.
But she was representing all residents.
And so the town's attorney said, you can't talk to these people during this litigation. Isn't that the gist of it?
That's a question of fact, Your Honor. The town had a meeting on March 10th of 2005 to discuss these issues, and the town had already engaged in a dialogue concerning these issues, and we contend that that was pretext.
Before you run out of your time, can you tell me one free speech case that you've cited in any of your briefs, either at the summary judgment stage or in our court?
Your Honor, single one. Your Honor,
just name one of them.
Your Honor,
There are none is the bottom line on that. You cite no free speech cases at all.
Right.
So the argument is undeveloped. You give us no explanation of what your free speech claim is. And it sounds like the record's just loaded with all kinds of speaking and no inhibition on speaking.
Your Honor, with regard to that, there are two more instances where the free speech was violated, and that would be when Bernard Howard attempted to speak and Terrell Taylor turned his back on him. And the
Does
other,
that stop him from speaking?
To not listen to his speaking.
So that's your claim, that the speech was not listened to. It's the right to be listened to?
I think that goes with a free speech violation.
You're well into your rebuttal time, so.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you would sit at the counsel table, please.
Good morning. My name is Michael Rappa, and I represent the town of Merrillville and the other town of Merrillville defendants. We are obviously here today to request that the court affirm the district court's decision to grant summary judgment in favor of the town defendants on the Section 1983 claims.
Can you keep your voice up?
Certainly. With respect to this, there's two primary issues as far as these claims. The comparator issue, and we put in our brief, we give a lengthy exposition demonstrating that of all the issues that the plaintiffs raised at the district court level, they could not show any kind of comparison between themselves and an unprotected group with regards to land use decisions done by the town, particularly as far as the approval of a subdivision unit and as far as the decisions to deal with stormwater and retention pond issues within neighborhoods. There's also the free speech issue. And I'll address that as we go along. But I think what the record does show is that there's an ample amount of speech that was conducted during the course of these events. And there's some very important facts about that, particularly the Benford King litigation with regards to that free speech issue. With respect to the comparator issue, what we did, when we filed summary judgment, we stated out the plain terms of here's what a 1983 claim is for equal protection. They need to meet these elements. And we lay that out. We also, what we did was we focused on the fact that there were a lack of comparators. We cited out about four or five different subdivisions that the plaintiffs were trying to compare themselves to. The district court followed that track. There was also a focus on Madison Meadows. And I'd like to talk about that because it's been talked about here a lot here today. The problem with Madison Meadows as far as a comparison is that it was on a different track than the Innsbruck issue. Innsbruck, final approval was given in July of 2001. Final plat was filed in September of 2004, but that was really a ministerial issue. The state statute is rather clear that if a remonstrator wants to contest a plan commission's decision to grant final approval, they have to then have 30 days to file in Circuit Court, Lake Circuit Court, a remonstration action contesting that decision. That should have been done in 2001. They want to compare themselves to Madison Meadows, which at that time in 2005, and there were a number of Innsbruck residents that were showing up in 2005 at Plan Commission meetings, characterizing themselves as remonstrators, watching what was going on with Madison Meadows. Madison Meadows' preliminary approval had not even been given on that development. There were zoning issues with respect to that development. I disagree with the characterization of the plaintiffs in terms of the zoning issues. With respect to Madison Meadows, it was a landlocked area. There were multiple housing units that were being developed in the front of that subdivision. There was a concern about the remaining part of that subdivision being landlocked. There was also a concern about drainage affecting an older subdivision that was adjacent to it, known as Southmore Park. A whole host of issues involving zoning, a whole host of issues as far as drainage, that went beyond the realm. Those were addressed during the time of the remonstration for Madison Meadows. Likewise, at that same time, what had happened was the developer in Madison Meadows was starting to conduct the infrastructure work on it before there was ever final approval. He's bringing boatloads of dirt in, and he's changing what was done as far as the specifications for drainage, as far as slope and height and all that. That is what the town called the developer on in terms of Madison Meadows. No such issue involving Innsbruck. What we had with Innsbruck was that Unit 6, which also at one point it originally incorporated Unit 7, because Unit 7 had not been finished, that the drainage was already set back in the early 80s. Krall, who was the developer's engineer, had given the specifications as far as the engineering. The town engineer looked at that and approved it based on the fact that he knew that Unit 6 had incorporated Unit 7's drainage and had already approved it. It was just a continuation of that. The plaintiffs are trying to mix apples and oranges with this as far as that.
What happened to the town's counterclaim?
The district court did not rule on that.
So where did it go?
At this point, what the district court said was that all the state law claims had been remanded.
Well, I want to ask you about that, too. Remanded to where?
Well, I have
a
question.
They started in federal court. Where do you remand them?
Originally, the plaintiffs had filed in state court. All the claims that they brought in...
wasn't removed, though.
No. What they did was in February of February of 2007, they filed their action. All the plaintiffs, all the same defendants, except for maybe a couple minor defendants, they filed that action in state court. Before the town ever filed an appearance, they dismissed that claim. They then filed a new action in federal court, adding the additional claim of the equal protection. That was the only difference. All right. We filed for summary judgment on all of it. Unfortunately, the court...
Including your counterclaim.
Including the counterclaim. Unfortunately, what happened was that the district court judge decided he was not going to rule on the state court matters. Now,
So he probably should have dismissed all of the state claims.
Probably, I think it's more of a wording. I think in essence it's a dismissal without prejudice. Now, what the plaintiffs do have is, under the Journey's Account statute, they do have the ability to refile that.
But they have not yet.
At this point, no. And at this point, the appeal that's pending right now involves four of those 21 plaintiffs. There's 17 plaintiffs that have not pursued the appeal in federal court. Conceivably, they can go forward on their own, and they can pursue the claims against the town, and they can pursue the claims against the developer, which remain, because against the developer were the claims about, negligence, and there was nuisance and implied warranty of habitability and all that. The district court did not rule on any of that. It was simply deemed dismissed without prejudice. At this point, what we have here, though, is as far as these issues, what's clear is that the town did not discriminate. They did not violate the equal protection of the plaintiffs. They're just following the law as far as what they need to do as far as administering their policy of not using public funds for private land. And that's the core issue here in this case, as far as what the plaintiffs wanted the defendants to do is to do exactly that.
Geographically, where are these subdivisions located?
Within the town of Maryville.
Well, I understand that. Where within the town of Maryville?
Within the town of Maryville, it is the Innsbrook area is on approximately 73rd and 65th in that area off of Taft Street. The area for...
describe whether it's north, south, east, or west.
For Innsbrook, it is west of Taft and north of 73rd. The area for Madison Meadows, that's off of just north of U.S. 30. I see my time is up, and I know that.
Not yet.
Well, I know I have the split time with.
It is now.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Claire Quish, and I represent Defendant Appellee John Wormeling. Plaintiff's argument this morning in the oral argument confirms Wormeling's position that plaintiffs, one, never intended to appeal as to any order granting summary judgment as to John Wormeling, and two, waived any arguments with respect to John Wormeling by failing to make any of those arguments in her appellate brief. First, we'd argue this court should dismiss this case against Wormeling for lack of appellate jurisdiction. Alternatively, this court should choose to look at the merits of the case. Plaintiffs have waived any arguments to Wormeling by failing to include it in their briefs. And two, plaintiffs have failed to come forward with any evidence or any facts to support their 1983 claim against Mr. Wormeling, who was a private individual employed by a private engineering company and not a state actor.
Lack of appellate jurisdiction, why?
Plaintiffs did not appeal from the district court's orders granting summary judgment as to Wormeling.
Their notice of appeal didn't include it.
Exactly, Your Honor. The town filed a separate motion for summary judgment. Wormeling and his employer, Robinson Engineering, filed their own motion. On December 2nd, the district court solely ruled on the town's motion for summary judgment. It listed the individuals to which that order applied. Mr. Wormeling was not included in that order. On December 3rd, the district court entered a separate order entering summary judgment in favor of Mr. Wormeling on plaintiff's 1983 claims.
And then there's a later order, like February?
15th, Your Honor, yes. We recognize that the December...
Your client's listed in that order, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. We recognize that the December 3rd order was not in compliance with Rule 58, so pursuant to this court's precedent and the rules, we filed a motion in the district court asking for that order.
Which is the February 15th.
Exactly, Your Honor. However,
but the notice of appeal had been filed prior to that order, prior to the February 15th order.
That's correct, Your Honor. The notice of appeal, however, does not include the December 3rd order as to Mr. Wormeling. Plaintiffs never amended or filed a new notice of appeal referencing either the December 3rd order or the February 15th order. Additionally, all of the pleadings that plaintiffs have filed in this case show their intent not to appeal as to Wormeling. The docketing statement mentions solely the December 2nd order. Their brief mentions solely the December 2nd order in the jurisdictional statement, in the statement of facts, in the argument section. No order as to Wormeling was mentioned in the brief at all. The appendix to Appellant's brief solely includes the December 2nd order, does not include the December 3rd order. So our argument, Your Honor, would be that this court has no jurisdiction over Wormeling because plaintiff's notice of appeal fails to comply with Rule 3 and this court's precedent requiring strict compliance with the rules. Additionally, Your Honor, if this court should choose to look at the merits of the argument, plaintiffs have failed to make any argument in their opening brief as to how the district court erred in granting summary judgment to Mr. Wormeling. Plaintiffs made one small argument in their reply brief. However, the arguments made in their reply brief are too late. We would argue that they'd be deemed waived. Even if this court is to choose to look at the merits of the claim, in order to prove a 1983 claim against Mr. Wormeling, plaintiffs must prove that he is a state actor. Those cases typically involve government officials, public officers, police officers. In this case, Mr. Wormeling, it's undisputed from the facts, that Mr. Wormeling was a private individual employed by a private engineering company. He was never employed by the town of Maryville. He had no authority. He sat on no town boards or town committees. He had no voting power at any town boards or town committees. He had no authority to approve a subdivision, to stop work in a subdivision, to require the town to take any detention pond into its inventory. No such power. Additionally, the first set of plans for the Innsbrook development were prepared and sealed in 1980. And the second set of plans were prepared and sealed in 2001. The town approved both sets of plans. Mr. Wormeling, however, did not come onto the scene until September 2004, long after all those plans were prepared and long after the town approved the development subdivision. Additionally, the facts show that Mr. Wormeling's role was simply to take direction from the town and to do tasks that the town asked him to do. He complied with the direction. He wasn't allowed to take any other authority beyond that. So thus, Your Honor, we would argue that plaintiffs have failed to present any facts whatsoever to show that Mr. Wormeling was a state actor, and thus their 1983 claim fails. For these reasons, and for those set forth in our brief, this Court should dismiss this appeal of Mr. Wormeling because plaintiffs failed to properly appeal from that order, granting summary judgment to Mr. Wormeling. And in the alternative, this Court should affirm the District Court's entry of summary judgment to Mr. Wormeling for two reasons. One, because plaintiffs waived all such arguments, and two, because plaintiffs failed to present any evidence whatsoever to show that Mr. Wormeling was a state actor who could be subject to liability under Section 1983. Thank you.
Thank you. State.
The December 3rd order specifically stated that the December 2nd order applied to Mr. Wormeling. Also, the December 2nd order said that the town defendants, and as try as they might to say that Wormeling was not a town defendant, he was associated with the town.
Did you make any argument in your brief, your opening brief, with regard to him?
With regard to
Wormeling.
No, I didn't, Your Honor, because I relied on the district court's decision that stated that the December 2nd order applied to John Wormeling. What happened was is that that order denied Mr. Wormeling's motion as moot. That's what the order did. And then it referred back to the December 2nd order saying that it applied to him. And that's the reason why only that order was appealed. He's had notice of this appeal. He's filed a brief, and substantial justice requires it because the district court stated that in the December 3rd order that the December 2nd order applied to Wormeling, that the appeal is perfected as to him. That's document 624, the December 3rd order, and if you read it, it clearly says that the December 2nd order applies to Wormeling. With regard to Innsbruck and the fact that the final plat wasn't recorded in Innsbruck Unit 4 until September 24th of 2004. At that time, the town still had power to do something about Innsbruck. It should have declared the plat void. Any argument that the town makes concerning statutory framework is waived. The first time they raise it is here on appeal. But even if it's not waived, signing of that plat was a ministerial act, Your Honor, and basically, when it's ministerial, a writ of mandamus can be issued, and you don't have to follow the statutory framework. They make a distinction saying that Madison Meadows wasn't the same as Innsbruck because there were violations involving field dirt. It is the same as Innsbruck because in document 525, attachment 1, it states that Innsbruck had IDIM violations. So there were IDIM violations in Innsbruck, and there were IDIM violations in Madison Meadows, and it does not make the two different. They're very close to one another. There are 7 ways they're the same. There are 15 ways that they were treated differently. And legislative immunity does not apply based on Brogan. We don't challenge the policy on retention ponds. What we're challenging is the application of the policy. And that was discriminatory. Mr. Wormeling was a private actor in conspiracy with the town. That can be shown in the record at document 537, exhibits 26 through 1. So his argument that he's not a private actor fails because he was in conspiracy with the town by giving it a clean bill of health in concert with the town manager, Timothy Brown. Your Honor, we feel that Costello applies. We feel that the argument was not made, that only the elements were set out in that brief. And furthermore, we feel that the two communities are the same in 7 ways, and they were treated differently in 15 ways, and it shows the record that it shouldn't be affirmed on those grounds.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel.